Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa, bringing you the News Gazette today on Wednesday, November 19th, 2025. Today on the front page is a large picture of a group of elementary school students cheering as they see themselves on the video board during Tuesday's field trip day to the Illinois women's basketball game at State Farm Center in Champaign. A crowd of 14,361 fans watched the Illini beat Murray State 84-64. And at the top of this page today, there's also a picture of the Parkland volleyball girls volleyball team chasing fifth national title. And that's exciting for them. We're going to begin with an article today about from the Cunningham Township that talks about the former armory in Champaign set to house winter emergency shelter. And there is a picture of the former National Guard building in Champaign there. This is by Jana Wiersema. Local realtor and property owner Phil Fiskella suspects that God has a sense of humor. After all, it's a bit ironic that Fiskella, a local critic of the city of Champaign Township, strides low barrier homeless shelter, has inked a lease with Cunningham Township to set up a winter emergency shelter in one of its buildings. You can't complain about something for very long until God gives you a solution, he said. That solution came earlier this year when the Illinois National Guard put its armory at 109 East Park Street in Champaign up for auction. It's Fiskella's understanding that the building was no longer needed due to a consolidation with the larger armory in Urbana. Prometheus Partners, LLC, managed by Fiskella and Anthony Grillo, bought the property and had initially planned to use it as an event venue. That might still be a possibility in the spring, Fiskella said. However, the building will serve as an emergency shelter for men through at least late April. The Cunningham Township Board, comprised of the same people as the Urbana City Council, voted Monday to approve a lease agreement with Prometheus Partners and a memorandum of understanding with Friend in Me to staff the operate the winter shelter. The lease, which began Tuesday, has an initial five-month term that ends April 30th. The arrangement will continue on a month-to-month basis thereafter, unless either party gives a 30-day notice that they want to terminate. Rent is $4,000 a month, and the township will also be responsible for utility costs. Fiskella said that the township is leasing almost the entire building and estimated that the space is about 20,000 square feet. Cunningham Township Supervisor Danielle Chenoweth said the township got a great deal on rent. They are essentially giving us the space at cost, she told the township board. According to Chenoweth, the space previously served as sleeping quarters and is equipped with a number of amenities that will be useful for the winter shelter, including a sick bay, 9 bathroom stalls, and 7 showers, including one that is wheelchair accessible. She said as of November 4th, there were 82 people in Champaign County without homes, and all shelters the township spoke with were at capacity, she reported. While 82 is a very reasonable number, Chenoweth said, it is also the largest number that we've ever seen going into the winter. She noted that while the township has worked to provide additional shelter during the winter since 2020, this year's need is a sizable increase compared with the 42 beds the township facilitated in 2004. At present, the armory will only provide nighttime shelter due to the amount of funding available for the project, she said. It will start out with 100 cots for men and male-identified residents, with the ability to expand to 176 if needed. The site will also serve a hot breakfast, coordinate transportation for residents, and provide connection to case management, healthcare, and services. Some of the residents who are staying with us will have established case managers at Strides, Chenoweth told the News Gazette. We also have case managers with us. And so folks will be linked to case managers. Once we stabilize as a nighttime-only shelter, then we can look to see how to add additional case management support and that may mean that we have some daytime hours for that. The Armory will host a neighborhood open house from 4 to 5 p.m. on Friday. It's expected to open Monday, pending approval from the City of Champaign, she said. At present, shelter hours will be 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., 7 nights a week. Men on Stride's wait list have already been screened, and 76 are waiting to stay at the winter shelter, Chenoweth said. In the past, Vizcala has criticized Stride's, located at 70 East Washington Street on the northern edge of downtown Champaign, as he feels that the shelter's low-barrier policies have caused problems for neighboring businesses and properties. However, he noted that the new winter shelter, will not allow people to loiter outside or leave their personal property on the parkways, sidewalks, or alleys. There's not going to be people hanging outside, Vizcala said. There's not going to be people drinking outside. And to some degree, being the landlord enables you to steer that. So I think we can assure the neighborhood that this is going to be run much better. He added that the temporary nature of the agreement means that Prometheus Partners LLC can choose not to renew the lease if things go poorly, though he feels optimistic that the winter shelter will not be disruptive in ways that Stride has been. According to Chenoweth, drug and alcohol use will not be permitted on or around the property. But residents will also not be tested for sobriety or excluded because they've been using. The township has a behavior-based approach to sheltering, she added. That means that certain behaviors that put other people or themselves at risk will not be tolerated and are not tolerated in our shelters, she said. We have a protocol, an escalation protocol, where we do verbal, written, and final case reviews. Obviously, if it's a serious offense, we will need to bring in law enforcement, but almost always, we can handle things internally. She also noted that individuals with mental health or substance abuse disorders tend to be a minority among the homeless community served by the township, and such individuals will be referred to intensive services. The winter shelter will require screenings, as it is right across the street from the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club, and therefore is not allowed to house registered sex offenders. Chenoweth said that Strides does not have that same restriction. There will be no drop-offs, including police or hospital, without a written agreement in place, period, she added. We will send people right back, and I will be notifying all the police jurisdictions and the hospitals. The procedure and policies and protocols, practices, all the P words that have been happening at Strides are totally untenable and need to stop. We are going to model a different approach that really has to do with the written agreement and protocols for the safety of everyone. Guests will need to be screened at either the Township Supervisor's office at 205 West Green Street or at Strides. We will be, at the beginning, having folks check in at Strides and then busing them over, she said. Plans also include not allowing exits or re-entries after 10 p.m., installing security cameras, and having security staff. She also noted that the township would like to do laundry daily, given some of the issues that we've seen at Strides, which had to close briefly in October after bed bugs were found on a guest. In discussing that partnership with Friend in Me, Chenoweth said that the local nonprofit has successfully worked with the township on pop-up shelters in the past and has developed relationships with the local homeless community. She added that Friend in Me leader Marco Price, Sherita Johnson, and Steve Day each have over 10 years of experience working with the homeless. Chenoweth described their approach as communal, while still enforcing boundaries and rules. Friend in Me has an approach of delivering a community amongst the folks, she said. They can do chores, they can help to clean up, they have breakfast together, and they start connecting with the staff members. She added that the group has also done a good job of engaging with neighbors in the past. In discussing the future, Chenoweth said that the township would like to eventually provide a drop-in space at the shelter during the day, but isn't ready to do so at this time. As for the possibility of extending the shelter past April, she said that the township will assess how to move forward based on its funding sources in the spring. I'm really excited to see where it goes, Fischella said. I think this is supposed to happen for a reason. This project is supported by $115,000 from the Illinois Department of Human Services, along with private donations, help from the City of Urbana, and contributions from Urbana-Champaign Friends Meeting. Chenoweth said she added that a variety of other individuals and groups have donated time and services for the effort. Additionally, the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District is a partner on the project and is providing cots, towels, bedding, fridges, and safety supplies. The health district will also help set up sick bays. The City of Champaign Township is providing referrals and support. Continuing on the front page is an article from Champaign about the Champaign fatal stabbing by Luke Taylor. Murder trial for Rantoul Man gets underway. Testimony includes first officer on the scene, victim's cousin who was dating suspect. By the time police arrived at the scene of a stabbing in Champaign, neighbors had already gathered around a woman whose neck had been slashed open, applying pressure to keep her stable. It wasn't until she had already been taken to a hospital that a K-9 unit discovered the other victim, the woman's boyfriend, 22-year-old Nathan G. Gudeman. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Alex Monambatua, 24, of Rantoul, has been charged with the four counts of first-degree murder, one count of attempted murder, and two counts of aggravated battery in relation to the March incident. His trial began Monday afternoon and is expected to close on Thursday. On Tuesday, the first officer to arrive to the scene took the stand. She testified that she had been parked only a couple of blocks away when the call came to respond to 1600 block of Healy Avenue shortly after midnight on March 22nd. Due to the nature of the call, she responded without her lights and siren to avoid, disturbing a possible suspect, which meant that her body camera did not activate automatically. She said she believed she activated it manually, but later realized that she had not. The officer said she found a large amount of blood between two vehicles as she approached on foot, then saw one of the victims sitting cross-legged on the front stoop of her home as a neighborhood held a towel to her neck. The officer took over, applying pressure, and began asking the victim questions as she waited on others to respond. On being asked who attacked her, the woman apparently said, "Alex, boyfriend, cousin," repeatedly, but the officer said the order changed. The words were confusing as the victim struggled to breathe. Another officer arrived soon afterward, and he did have his body camera recording as he approached the scene. He found the first officer still holding the victim's neck with large amounts of blood pooling on the stoop around her. He was able to provide gauze and get the victim out of her shirt, revealing another wound to her side. And minutes later, the officers were assisted by EMTs, who rushed the victim to the hospital. Meanwhile, another police officer, who was a K-9 handler, followed the dog to a neighboring house, where he found Mr. Goodman outside. In previous court hearings on the case, State's Attorney Julia Reed said that the reason for the attack was unknown, but Monambatua was in a relationship with a relative of the female victim. Monambatua's partner at the time also testified Tuesday, saying that he had recently become upset with her conversations with her cousin, the female victim. She had been venting about some things he had said or done to her recently, including her fears that he was cheating on her, and the conversation was captured on the dash cam of her and Monambatua's vehicle. She said Monambatua started calling the female victim a bad influence on her, but that he still seemed to like Mr. Goodman. A forensic pathologist and a doctor testified on Tuesday as well, describing injuries to both victims. The trial is set to continue this morning. In an article under Our Communities in Section A8, an article from the Secretary of State by Brendan Moore, driver's license, state IDs going digital starting today. Access allowed on Apple Wallet now. Availability coming soon for Google and Samsung. Illinois driver's license and identification cards will officially enter the digital realm this week. Secretary of State Alexei Giannoulias announced Tuesday that people will now have the option to add their Illinois-issued licenses and IDs to the digital wallets on their cell phones. The long-awaited technological advancement will allow digital IDs to be used to enter a bar or at an airport checkpoint, among other situations. The option will be available in Apple Wallet starting today, with plans to expand the program to Google and Samsung wallets soon, Giannoulias said, calling it a game-changer. Your ID now lives securely in the same place that you already tap to pay for groceries, present a boarding pass for a flight, or enter a concert, all protected by the same cutting-edge privacy and encryption technology that you trust every day on the devices that you already love, Giannoulias said. A rollout comes a year and a half after state lawmakers passed and Governor J.B. Pritzker signed legislation authorizing Giannoulias' office to move forward with the technology. Giannoulias announced in January that his office had begun working with Apple in hopes of having the feature ready by the end of this year. Illinois is now among a dozen states, including Maryland, Missouri, and Iowa, that offer driver's license and IDs in digital wallets. The digital cards are in addition to, and not instead of, a physical ID under the law, which means that public agencies and private entities can accept electronic IDs in place of physical ones, but they don't have to. And people will still have to carry their physical license or ID with them, even if they opt to use the digital version. How to set it up? To add to their phones, people will have to scan their physical driver's license or ID and take a selfie, which will be provided to the state for verification. They will also be prompted to complete a series of facial and head movements during the setup process. Authentication via facial or touch ID will be required before information is shared. The Secretary of State's office is also launching a free verifier app for businesses to allow them to check proof of age for restrictive purchases like alcohol. But instead of presenting the entire ID, it will allow for the display of only pertinent information, such as age, while shielding what is deemed immaterial. This technology gives us a smarter, faster way to verify age at concessions, helping us to reduce lines and keep fans focused on what they came for, the show, said Luca Sierra, director of marketing at Soldier Field. The presentation of a digital license to a law enforcement officer does not give them consent to search the device. Giannoulias said that the mobile ID will be permitted for use at TSA checkpoints at Chicago's O'Hare Airport and also at Midway, Lambert Airport in St. Louis, and more than 250 airports nationwide. Let's take a break now and head over to the opinion section and find out what J. Mark Powell has written about in his Holy Cow History. Today, there's a very colorful picture of a painting called The First Thanksgiving, 1621, an oil-on-canvas painting created by John Leon Jerome Ferris between 1912 and 1915. In addition to other historical inaccuracies, is this romanticized take. The clothing worn by the pilgrims is incorrect. The Wampanoag Native Americans did not wear feathered war bonnets and would not have been sitting on the ground. There's also no reference to the vast amounts of beer that were present, unless you count the tankard in the hand of the man wearing a sword at right. And the article's called Thanksgiving, America's Original Beer Bash. A holiday question persists year after year, probably stretching all the way back to the first Thanksgiving feast in 1621. What are we going to do with all the uneaten turkey? For a full range of post-Thanksgiving turkey menu options, turn to Ralphie's gastronomical rant at the end of A Christmas Story. The pilgrims, on the other hand, could have asked a different question after that first celebration exactly 400 years ago. What are we going to do with all the empty kegs? Because the pilgrims drank beer with their big meal, lots and lots of beer, in fact. It's one tradition that somehow didn't get passed down over the years, which is why nobody ever says, pass the Pabst Blue Ribbon, will you? while gathered around Aunt Margaret's elegantly appointed Thanksgiving table. But trust me, beer was there in 1621. In fact, beer was the reason the pilgrims set foot in Massachusetts in the first place. After 2 months at sea, the travelers were facing several pressing problems. First, despite having originally set out for the Virginia colony, they were way off course. The trip had lasted much longer than expected. But worst of all, they were running low on beer. Dangerously low. Each person was issued roughly a gallon of suds every day. And although the journey was a one-way trip for the pilgrims, Captain Christopher Jones and the Mayflower's crew would have to cross the Atlantic again to get home, and he worried there wouldn't be enough to last. William Bradford was growing anxious about the dwindling beer supply. That was why the group ultimately decided to drop anchor and set foot on Cape Cod. You know the story from there. Let's face it, though they are key players in the tale of America's founding, pilgrims weren't exactly party animals. Fun is a word rarely associated with them. Then why did they drink so much of a beverage far more likely to be consumed at a frat party or biker rally than at a Baptist convention? Because beer was how they stayed hydrated. The water carried on board the Mayflower quickly grew brackish and turned into a health hazard. The brewing process killed dangerous organisms and made the water in beer safe to drink. Even when the pilgrims finally came ashore in Massachusetts, they had to be very careful with the water that they found there. Remember, there were no water departments back then to purify drinking water. Brewing it was the safest bet. In fact, there's a theory of human history that the discovery of distilled spirits, heavy on calories, light on dangerous microorganisms, was key to the development of modern society. Forget Homo sapien. We should be honoring Homer Simpson. And make no mistake, the pilgrims weren't popping open bottles of O'Doul's non-alcoholic beer. The brewskis they downed, even the kids, contained 6% alcohol. It was the real McCoy. As Puritanism spread through New England and safe water sources were discovered, beer consumption gradually fell out of favor. Since early preachers associated it with sin, it wouldn't do to perpetuate its legacy during the annual fall feast. Beer was quietly erased from the menu of the first Thanksgiving. Quite a few other items that were served in 1621 aren't consumed at today's Thanksgiving dinner as well. Not many Americans stuff themselves with venison, cabbage, peas, wild onions, or boiled cornmeal. All were likely served that first time, along with grapes, gooseberries, and plums. We also know that the very first Thanksgiving lasted 3 days. The ample beer supply explains all that. Another article in Our Communities by Luke Taylor from Champaign. Saturday's Illini Military Appreciation Game. Field-size flag displays canceled after winds tossed 2 flag bearers. A plan to roll out a field-size American flag during the Illini Military Appreciation Game on Saturday was called off after 2 flag bearers were thrown into the air during a morning practice run. Apparently, winds caught the edge of a massive flag and went under it despite numerous flag bearers holding the edges, flinging one side into the air with 2 individuals still holding on. Brett Moore, Assistant Director for Athletics for Communication, said one of the people who fell was offered medical assistance but declined transport to a hospital. Following the practice and after consultation with Superflag staff and the event management personnel, the flag was canceled due to forecasted high winds prior to kickoff. And in other area news, from Danville by Jennifer Bailey, Larry Thompson, a life remembered, an incredibly valuable director and leader. Longtime director of public safety in Danville died last week at age 78. In Larry Thompson's day, the positions of police and fire chief took up a single line on the city's administrative organizational chart. One person for what have been since split into 2 jobs. Larry was such an instrumental force in advancing public safety in Danville. Former Mayor Scott Eisenhower said Tuesday, the understanding and knowledge that he had of both police and fire operations, the budget process, his ability to analyze and evaluate procedures and policies, and most importantly, his willingness and dedication to building relationships and partnerships in the community, allowing him to communicate and work with residents to solve problems, all made him an incredibly valuable director and leader of this city. Thomason, who died last week at age 78, is being remembered for his service to his community and country. Beyond the 13 years he spent as Danville's public safety director, Eisenhower said he was one of the most inspirational mentors and greatest friend I ever had, and I enjoyed working every day with him, learning from him, watching him guide others, and conversing with him about his love for his family, his job, and his community. He will be greatly, greatly missed, and all of our lives are a whole lot better because he was in it. Danville Police Chief Chris Yates, who was a commander of the patrol division when Mr. Thomason retired, said the former director was committed and dedicated to the city of Danville and Danville Police. Yates said that Mr. Thomason was always available and very clear about his open-door policy as director, even during the tensest of times, like when the city experienced the unthinkable, a church bombing. That was a high-stress circumstance, Yates said. Running two big departments like Mr. Thomason did was a very difficult task. To be able to have oversight over two different departments and have a lot of differences, Yates said. It's a very difficult role to be able to satisfy the needs of both of these departments. Former Deputy Director Bob Richard recalled when Mr. Thomason was a cadet, starting with Danville Police. He is one of those guys who worked through and achieved his dream, Richard said. Yates said Mr. Thomason proudly served his country or the community from 1966 to 2019. A Vietnam veteran, he was in the U.S. Army from 1966 to 68. 2 years later, he began a 49-year career on the Danville Police Force, retiring in 2019. Vermilion County 911 posted on social media that it joined its law enforcement partners in mourning Mr. Thomason's death. His dedication, leadership, and lifelong commitment to serving our community will never be forgotten, agency officials stated. Director Thomason, thank you for your years of service and for the lasting impact that you made on the city of Danville. We have the watch from here. A funeral service is set for 11 a.m. Thursday at Danville Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center. Visitation is set for 5 to 8 p.m. today at the funeral home. And there's a picture of Larry Thomason as he spent his 49 years with Danville Police, including 13 as Director of Public Safety, before retiring in 2019. He died last week at age 78. And from Arcola, an article about PBL Assistant Superintendent and areas around the school area, chosen for top post in Arcola. A Potomac teacher-turned-Paxton administrator will add a new title to her resume come summer, superintendent. Urbana resident Tara Chandler, in her third year as assistant superintendent of Paxton Buckley Lota Schools, was hired this week to succeed the retiring Tom Mulligan as Arcola District Superintendent effective July 1st. Her extensive background in curriculum leadership, building administration, and district-level management make her an ideal leader to build upon the strong foundation that Dr. Mulligan has established in 12 years as superintendent, Arcola School Board President Lucas Schonkweiler said. Her commitment to collaboration and student-centered decision-making aligns perfectly with our district values. Since earning the first of two degrees from Eastern Illinois University in 1996, Chandler has worked in public education in two area districts, teaching third grade in Potomac Grade School and holding a number of roles at PBL, including principal at Eastlawn, and 14 years as the district's director of curriculum, instruction, and assessment. Chandler also had a successful three-year run as varsity girls basketball coach at Armstrong Township, going 65-20 and leading the school to back-to-back Sangamon Valley Conference championships. She said she can't wait to lead, to listen, and to serve, and continue building a district focused on excellence in Arcola. And we are going to take a short break here with our first half of the News Gazette. I will be back shortly.